Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast. My name is Kevin Grosso, and I am your host for today's episode, which is the third episode in our series on biblical language linguistics. This is the third of four introductory episodes we are doing to introduce linguistic concepts to help us analyze biblical Hebrew and Greek. So today, we will be talking about syntax. In the first episode, we talked about semantics. In the second episode, we talked about morphology. And today, we are going to dive into syntax. So just a word of caution at the beginning. This episode in particular has a lot of graphics associated with it. So you can listen to it, and I will be doing my best to explain everything so you don't have to look at the screen. But I do have slides with syntax trees and other things that might be helpful for you to see what's going on. And so if you want to look at the video on YouTube or the blog post after, it would be highly recommended for this episode in particular. So syntax is about the order of morphemes. It is highly relevant for both semantics and morphology. In our intro to semantics, we define compositionality as the principle whereby the meaning of a complex expression is equivalent to the meaning of its parts and how they are combined. In syntax, we are dealing with how morphemes are combined. So according to the principle of compositionality, this will affect how complex expressions are interpreted. In our intro to morphology, we began with a quote from Embick's 2015 book on the morpheme. He said, "According to the view that is developed in this book, the primitive elements are morphemes, and the system responsible for combining morphemes into complex structures is the syntax." In other words, it is syntax that is organizing morphemes, and this organization helps to give complex structures their meaning. We can't introduce syntax without talking about which framework we are adopting. So far and away, the most influential person with regard to the modern study of syntax is Noam Chomsky, who is often called the father of modern linguistics. Chomsky developed a theory called generative grammar, which is essentially the enterprise of trying to specify what sentences are grammatical based on a limited set of rules. Because we can form an infinite variety of sentences, this is no small task. Crucially, this endeavor makes reference both to what is grammatical and what is ungrammatical, since we have to have rules that allow certain structures but disallow other structures. For example, we can say that the cat in English, as well as a cat. And while we can add the plural to make the cats, we would never say a cats with the plural after a. The fundamental question is, why do we consider a cats to be ungrammatical? Put differently, why don't we ever find that combination of morphemes in natural language in English? Syntax helps us to answer these kinds of questions. So there are all kinds of subtopics we could focus on in syntax. We will focus our attention on how syntax interfaces with semantics. So this leads us to the task of syntax, or what it is we're actually doing when we do syntax. So here's a quote from Andrew Carnegie's book. He has a very famous introductory textbook on syntax from a generative perspective. And this is what he says on page 4. He says, "Syntax studies the level of language that lies between words and the meaning of utterances, sentences. It is the level that mediates between sounds that someone produces, organized into words, and what they intend to say. Perhaps one of the truly amazing aspects of the study of language is not the origins of the word demerit, or how to properly punctuate a quote inside parentheses, or how kids have, like, destroyed the English language, huh? Instead, it's the question of how we subconsciously get from sounds and words to meaning. This is the study of syntax." Okay, so the way Carney is presenting syntax is as this bridge between meaning and the sounds that we produce. So just one last thing before we get started. In previous introductory episodes, we had just one sentence, but in this episode, we will have several in order to introduce different syntactic phenomenon. If you are watching this and you can see my screen, there is a convention in linguistics that you may or may not be aware of. In order to indicate something as ungrammatical, you normally put an asterisk before the sentence. So that says this sentence is actually not allowed in English. So if you see that on the screen, that's what that is. So today we are talking about syntax and different syntactic concepts. So the first thing we're going to do is look at some key terms. So the key terms we're going to be looking at are phonological or phonetic and logical form, heads and phrases, arguments and adjuncts, complements and specifiers, and then movement. And then next, we're going to look at specific phrases that are very important for the study of syntax. So we're going to look at the verb phrase, and that's a little v plus phrase. And that is a crucial distinction we'll discuss later. Next, we'll look at the inflectional phrase, or IP. Then we'll look at the determiner phrase, or DP. And finally, we'll look at the complementizer phrase, or CP. So we will begin with talking about phonetic and logical form. Just a quick definition. Phonetic form is the form that morphemes take when pronounced, and logical form is the order in which the morphemes are interpreted. So this basic distinction, it has really driven a lot of syntax. So this is very similar to, you know, what used to be called surface structure and deep structure. For example, deep structure being closer to logical form, surface structure being closer to phonetic form. Phonetic form and logical form are the terms that are used today. But the idea is that in any given sentence, we may have a mismatch between how the sentence is pronounced and how it is interpreted. And so we have to separate out these two things. So the example sentence we have is, every boy hugged a girl. So the question is, how many girls are there, right? The sentence is actually ambiguous. So it could be the case that every boy hugged a single girl, in which case there's only one girl, or it could be the case that every boy hugged any girl, right? So there could be three girls, right? And every single boy in whatever group hugged at least one girl. This is an empirical fact, right? I mean, it's just not deniable that humans, native speakers of English, can understand this sentence in those two distinct ways, right? And it's also true that in both cases, we pronounce the sentence in the exact same way. Every boy hugged a girl. So we have to, at some level, separate out, you know, these two ideas, right? That a sentence can be pronounced in a certain way and interpreted in a different way. So in other words, the order we see or hear on the surface is not always the order in which we interpret the morphemes. So interpretation is not equivalent to phonetic form. And interpretation, this also means, is not always visible or audible, right? So the question then is, how do we decide how to interpret this? So the key would be the context, right? It would be, okay, is there some girl in the context, some salient individual that, you know, leads us to interpret a girl as one specific girl, or do we know from the context that there are multiple girls involved? So that is what is going to disambiguate this sentence, but the point is that the sentence itself is not going to do that for us. So there is some other mechanism by which we can understand this sentence in the right way as the speaker intended. Okay, but the point then is that the interpretation is not always going to be plain and on the surface. That's the idea. So next we have heads and phrases. These are two very important syntactic terms, really foundational. A head is the morpheme that gives the lexical or grammatical category of the whole phrase. And a phrase is a group of morphemes that acts as a unit and whose category is determined by the head. Let me just give an example here, and hopefully this will make some sense. We can look at this sentence. We'll use this sentence several times throughout. Ezra gave his stuffed animal to a child at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. when we look at a child is a phrase. And so we're going to later define that phrase as a determiner phrase. Okay. So a is the determiner and child is the noun. So a child, that whole unit is a determiner phrase, which means that the head of the phrase, that whole phrase, is a determiner, a. So these are just terms that you need to know so that we can talk about structure. Okay, so it's in some sense, you know, they're arbitrary terms. We could call them whatever we want, but it helps us to talk about structures in a systematic way. So we can also talk about, you know, a verb phrase. Okay, so a verb phrase has a head, which is the verb, right? That's just by definition what a verb phrase is and what a head of a verb phrase is. So in this case, it would be gave his stuffed animal to a child. That would be the whole verb phrase. And basically, the phrase includes both the head and the arguments of the head. So what that means is if we define that as the phrase, gave a stuffed animal to a child, it means that the verb give requires certain arguments, and we're going to define this next. It defines certain arguments, or it requires certain arguments, and those arguments form the whole phrase. That's the idea. So the implication of this is that morphemes that occur in the same phrase are interpreted together. They are closer. So the whole idea behind drawing syntactic trees is to show structure and to show which phrases are interpreted together. So for example, when I say his stuffed animal, that's a phrase, and versus a child, the A in a child is specifying child, right? It's further clarifying how many children and what kind of child, as opposed to, you know, the child, right? A child is not known. The child is known, as a very rough approximation. So A is affecting the meaning of child, whereas his stuffed animal, right? His stuffed, or let's just say his stuffed animal, his is affecting stuffed animal, right? His is not affecting child in this example. So the idea is that phrases, by dividing up sentences and words into phrases, we can see which words are interpreted together. That's the basic idea. So that brings us to arguments and adjuncts. So we've discussed arguments in different places, but now we're going to discuss it in terms of syntax. An argument, syntactically, is an item that completes the thought of a predicate. And it's honestly very hard to separate this idea from semantics. And so I'm going to be a little bit blurry with this. There's a lot of work done on separating these two things, a syntactic argument versus a semantic argument. But we're just going to kind of leave that issue aside for now. Let me go over this definition of argument again. It's an item that completes the thought of a predicate. And an adjunct is an item that adds additional information to a predicate, but is not required to make it a complete thought. So again, for example, if I just said Ezra gave, I don't know what he gave, right? And that sounds, outside of, you know, any context, that is a very incomplete thought. What did he give? Who did he give it to, right? So that's what I would be asking. Or if I just said gave a stuffed animal to a child, I would say who? Right? That's the question you would ask, right? So this verb give requires certain elements to complete the thought that it has, right? To complete its meaning, right? So give requires someone to give. Give requires something to be given, and give requires a recipient of some kind. Okay? So those are the arguments of the verb give. Those are the things that are required to complete the thought. So if I just said Ezra gave, what I would do naturally so there are examples like this, you know, in natural language. So we can say something like, you know, did everyone give what was required of them? And we might say, well, Ezra gave. On the surface, it looks like there's no object there, or there's no argument for what was given and who the recipient is. But in reality, we understand as just, well, Ezra gave, we understand that sentence as still having those arguments, right? Those participants are still there. So that's the key here, is that even if they're not there phonetically, they are there logically. So the logical form for give is always has those three components, right? The giver, the recipient, the thing given, okay? Even if sometimes in the phonetic form, we don't see that. This is different than adjuncts. So I have put in parentheses the adjuncts in this sentence. So again, I'll read the sentence. Ezra gave his stuffed animal to a child at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. So at 3 p.m. and on Wednesday are adjuncts. They are not arguments of the verb. We can say Ezra gave his stuffed animal to a child, and that is a complete thought. We can add at 3 p.m., and we can add on Wednesday, and we can add all kinds of other things, right? In his room, for example. So those further specify, you know, where and when, how maybe these things took place, but they don't complete the thought of the verb give. So again, the verb give requires a certain number of arguments, and it's limited in number. But there are potentially an infinite number of adjuncts that we could add to this sentence. There is no constraint on the number of adjuncts given by the grammar. That's the idea. There is a constraint just, you know, in human language and processing, but in the syntax, there is, in theory, no constraint. That's the distinction between arguments and adjuncts. One is required by the verb and one is not. Arguments and adjuncts are often interpreted differently as well. For example, there's a specific role that the arguments are playing in this sentence. Ezra gave a stuffed animal to a child. The stuffed animal, for example, is affected by the verb in a specific way. And that's usually what an argument, semantically, what ends up happening is the argument is affected by the verb in some way. Whereas at 3 p.m. and on Wednesday, those specify something about the event, but they are interpreted differently. They're less necessary, right, for us to describe the actual event. And there's all kinds of work done on, you know, the way arguments are interpreted. The common way is through theta roles. You don't really need to know that. If you are interested in it, that's what you can Google. There's all kinds of work as well on what kinds of meanings adjuncts can have. It's also sometimes difficult to tell if a word is an argument or an adjunct. So, for example, stuffed animal is pretty difficult. So the question would be, is stuffed animal a compound word, or is stuffed an adjunct to animal? I would analyze it as a compound word, but it can get very tricky in some cases whether something is an argument or an adjunct of certain words. So you have to be very careful about how you're defining these terms, and then also what kinds of tests you can do to determine whether something is an argument or an adjunct. And again, there's lots of tests out there for that, which we're not going to get into right now. Next, we will move to complements and specifiers. So complements and specifiers are different kinds of arguments. A complement is an argument that combines directly with the head of a phrase. Okay, so we're going to look at this more closely. Specifier is an argument that combines with the combination of the head and complement. And this has been traditionally called X bar. Okay, so let me explain this in more detail. So if we have, let's just say a verb, a verb's complement is going to be its direct object. Okay, so the sentence we have here is Cooper threw a baseball. Okay, so threw a baseball. So threw is the verb. A baseball would be the complement. Now, those two things combine first, right? And there are reasons why people have said this. So the idea is that those two things combine first, and then the specifier of that phrase is another argument, right? It is required, but it combines with both the verb and the complement of the verb. So first we would say, in the sentence, Cooper threw a baseball, we would say threw a baseball is one unit. And then that whole unit combines with Cooper. So the threw a baseball unit is what's called X bar. And again, you can look up X bar theory if you want to. It's a very old syntactic theory at this point, but this just allows us to look structurally at how things combine, right? And for us to give it a name, a label to different kinds of arguments that words can have, okay? So what people have noticed is that arguments may have different positions in the syntax, and this affects how they are interpreted. For example, there is something called the no agent idiom hypothesis. So this example actually is from Marantz, 1984. He notices that if you say through a baseball, right, you have one interpretation, then you can say something like through his support behind a candidate, through a boxing match, through a party, through a fit, where all of these complements, right, these are not specifiers, these are all direct objects of the verb through, they're all affecting the interpretation of the verb in a unique way, right? It's very different to throw a baseball than to throw a boxing match, or throw a baseball and throw a party, or throw a baseball and throw a fit, right? So we have all of these idiomatic meanings when verbs combine with complements sometimes, right? With some verbs and in some cases. But what we don't normally have is idiomatic meanings when a verb and its complement combines with a specifier or a subject. The point is that an agent is normally in the specifier position. And so Marantz says, okay, actually, idioms, there is a logic to them. They are going to have a verb and a complement, but we're not going to have an idiom where the idiom is formed with a verb and its specifier, right? Specifically, when that specifier is an agent, right? So in Cooper threw a baseball or Cooper threw a boxing match, you know, if I said the referee threw a baseball or the referee threw a boxing match, that doesn't change the interpretation of the sentence, right? I mean, we still have that different meaning of through regardless of the subject, right? So if we have Cooper or the referee, either way, we have the same interpretation. So that's the issue here, is that complements and specifiers behave differently, and so they are going to do different things in the syntax. Just to point out the like prototypical complement, I said this before, but just to, it bears repeating, the prototypical complement is the direct object. So, you know, if you just say, what is the complement of a verb? That's going to be the direct object. There are, you know, we can talk about prepositional complements as well of verbs, but that's, you should just be aware of complement of a verb normally equals direct object. Now we move on to our last key term, which is movement. Movement is something that I think some people are skeptical of because it seems weird, right? Why are things moving around this? Why are words moving around in the sentence? And this is exactly what movement is, right? When a morpheme changes location in the sentence. And it usually involves a head moving to a head position or a phrase moving to a phrase position. So for example, one common, you know, way that a verb can move is a verb can move to what's called the complementizer position. So this is called V to C movement. So we will talk about this more later. But what you won't have is a verb moving to the complementizer phrase position. So we want to say heads move to heads and phrases move to phrases. So, you know, the verb phrase might move to a complementizer phrase position, for example. But a verb is going to move to another head position. The implications of this. So first of all, things move. And so the question is, why and are there constraints? So an example of this is Ezra is giving his stuffed animal to a child. So again, Ezra is giving his stuffed animal to a child. we can move the verb, the auxiliary verb is, to the first part in the sentence. Is Ezra giving his stuffed animal to a child? And all of a sudden, we interpret this as a question. You know, the obvious, you know, question is why? Why does this happen? Why do we move the verb to the front of the sentence to make a question, right? And this, we do this intuitively, right? And it's, you know, you might ask, well, why do you care? The what's interesting about this is that in language after language after language, we find this, that question words often appear near the beginning of the sentence. And so that's a really interesting. Why is it that all these unrelated languages do the exact same thing, right? Or something very similar. The question is, again, why we have this movement. But, you know, on the surface, we can say, just empirically, that movement is often a signal to interpret something differently. When we do have this movement, we do have a difference in interpretation. We are using movement, syntactic movement, for meaning. And that's crucial. So, again, this is where compositionality is huge. When I say Ezra is giving his stuffed animal to a child, that is interpreted in a certain way. I have the exact same words in is Ezra giving his stuffed animal to a child. But once I change the order, the morphemes are interpreted differently. And so I have a different interpretation once the order is has changed, right? So the complex expression, again, even though all the individual components are the same, the complex expression is something different because those individual units have combined differently. That's the idea, right? That's how syntax will affect meaning. And there's all kinds of, you know, ways that syntax affects meaning. But this is just one very clear, simple example of how this works. So at this point, let's move on to talk about important phrases that we find in the linguistics literature. So we've already said what a phrase is. It's some sort of unit that acts together syntactically. So there are all kinds of these units that are significant in various ways. If you remember, we, in the morphology and the semantics episode, we talked about functional and lexical morphemes, or grammatical and lexical morphemes. The functional morphemes contribute logical meanings and they combine with lexical items. So one of the things that we're going to look at is phrases that are built on functional morphemes. So these functional morphemes are going to take lexical morphemes as arguments. So again, I mentioned this earlier, like a boy, right? A is the functional morpheme there, and it's going to take boy, the lexical morpheme, the noun in this case, as an argument. That's a whole phrase. It's a unit that acts together, and we are going to discuss the significance of that and how these functional morphemes play themselves out. So we're going to begin, though, with what's called the VP. And if you notice, those of you that can see here, it's a small V. So this is significant. The little V stands for the categorizer. So what we're dealing with here is the verb categorizer, right? So that it takes a root and it turns that root into a verb, okay? So this is how we're going to define the VP. It's the lexical projection that forms the core of a clause and which specifies which arguments are necessary to complete the thought of the predicate. And we have a few other definitions here, but I want to start with these examples. We have, this is from Hale and Kaiser, 2002, a very important work on, yeah, all things verbs and arguments. So they start the book off with this example, these few examples. The pot broke, the engine coughed. Okay, so we have, in the pot broke, we have an intransitive sentence, right? And then in the engine coughed, we also have an intransitive sentence. And then they say, okay, with the pot broke, we can add an extra argument. We can say, I broke the pot, right? But this is not possible with cough. We cannot say, I coughed the engine. It just doesn't work. They start out the book saying, why is this the case? And their theory is that there's something about the lexical item break that is structurally different than the lexical item cough, even though when you look on the surface in both intransitive examples, they look identical, right? The pot broke, the engine coughed, both intransitive sentences, both one argument. But the fact that you can alternate the pot broke with I broke the pot, and you can't alternate the engine coughed with I coughed the engine, shows that structurally they're different. This is actually a very well-known thing in linguistics. I mean, they start out with an easy example because it's the introductory, or it's the introduction to the book. But the analysis, the standard analysis, is that the pot broke is what's called an unaccusative, which is an intransitive verb where the only argument in the clause is VP internal. So the idea here is that the argument, the pot, is inside of the verb phrase. And you can see this in the, if you're watching this, you can see this in the syntactic trees. We have V combining with the root break to form a verb. And then next to that is the DP, the pot. So that whole thing is the verb phrase. Okay, so the pot break is part of the verb phrase. So the argument, the pot, is internal to the verb phrase. This is in contrast to an unergative verb, which is an intransitive verb where the only argument of the verb is introduced outside of the verb phrase. So in this case, when the verb combines with cough, it doesn't take an argument inside of that verb phrase. When I then go to add an argument in the pot break, right, I can, if there's some other, something else that can introduce an argument, I'm going to end up with two arguments. With cough, if there's something else that introduces the argument, because there has to be an argument of cough, I only end up with one argument. That's the basic idea. Voice is the thing that introduces the extra argument. So voice introduces or modifies the external argument of the verb. So again, let's just look at this. In the pot broke, we have an argument, the pot, of the verb break. Now, I can add an extra argument, I. This is an agent to this sentence. I broke the pot. The idea is, this is kind of the standard analysis, is that the agent is introduced by voice, active voice. So active voice will introduce this extra argument, and that allows this alternation, right? We have one argument from voice, one argument from the verb itself, from break. In contrast, the engine cough, the verb itself, does not have an argument associated with it. So we need a subject, right? Something has to cough. So that means that voice is the only thing that introduces the argument. So when we put active voice on there, we have an argument, but we only have one argument because cough itself does not have an argument, okay? So that creates this asymmetry where we have the pot broke versus the engine coughed. We can see on the surface, these are identical. At a syntactic level, they are not, right? They behave differently. And the only way you see this is by looking at all the data, right? If you were to just look at these two sentences, you would say, oh, okay, they're both intransitive. Maybe they're the same. But when you look at the broad range of uses of the word break, you see that it behaves fundamentally different than cough, right? And Hale and Kaiser's claim is that this is a structural difference between break and cough. Break takes an argument itself. Cough itself does not take an argument. Okay, and we see this show up in how it's used differently syntactically. The point here is that words can have the same surface structure in some instances, but have different underlying structures that result in those surface structures. So two, in our case, we looked at two different kinds of intransitives, okay? And this really means you have to look at all of the uses of the verb to determine its structure. Along with the verb phrase, we did talk last time in the morphology introductory episode about nominalizations. And I wanted to just touch on this really quick because I think it's an important point here. And when we are discussing the verb phrase, we are discussing a lexical phrase. Again, little v stands for the the categorizer verb, right? So it's gonna take a root and it's gonna make a verb out of it. An important point here is that there are, as we said with the morphology episode, there are some nouns that behave a lot like verbs. So, you know, this is an example from, I believe it's from Grimshaw, the examination of the student driver lasted 1 hour. And this is, you know, a very typical example where we have the examination as the nominalization. The analysis here is that examine takes an argument. So we can say, you know, the doctor examined the student driver for 1 hour. That structure is the same as the examination of the student driver lasted 1 hour. It's the same in the sense that the argument with the verb, the student driver, right, is present with the nominalization as well. So the examination of the student, right, of the student driver, is the argument that was present with the verb. So the point here is that derived words can take syntactic properties from words that they combined with. So when a root combines with a verb, and that combination has an argument, when you then put a noun on top of that, like in the case of examine and examination, it can keep the argument structure from the verb. So this is how words are built, complex words in particular. So there are all kinds of complex words, right? And this gets very, very complex in cases, you know, when we don't see the argument, in other cases where we do see the argument. But what I want us to see here is that the verb, right, if it combines with another lexical category on top of it, it can have that same argument structure. And that has all sorts of consequences for the meaning of the verb, as well as the meaning of the noun that results. And this can work for adjectives, right, that combine with other categories. I think this is a huge, huge field in linguistics where people are trying to figure out what these kinds of nouns mean, these derived nouns, these nouns with a verb underneath them, and trying to figure out how this is affected by the argument structure of the verb. So those are two kind of areas that I wanted to touch on with these lexical categories. So again, the first one really being dividing verbs, or you can do this with adjectives and nouns as well, dividing up lexical morphemes into classes based on their syntactic properties. Okay, that is a massive field in linguistics. And then the second one is deriving complex words and their syntactic properties based on the pieces that form those complex words, right? Like, for example, examination, it having the arguments of examine. Why does it do that? The fact is that it does. And it does sometimes and not at other times, right? And that's the really tricky part. So there's been a ton of work on this. Grimshaw is the place to start. Grimshaw 1990, I'll post a link to this. It's a very interesting thing. And those two things, dividing up words into classes, syntactic classes, and looking at the property of derived words are two massive areas in linguistics. So let's move on now to more functional categories. The first one is the inflectional phrase. A ton of work has been done here. The inflectional phrase really, I'm going to say, is equivalent to the tense phrase. It's you know, those two terms are often used interchangeably. But the definition we have for it is the functional projection that takes a VP as an argument to anchor the event or state in time. So once we've established, you know, the type of event we're dealing with, then we're going to anchor that event in time using all sorts of aspectual markers, tense markers, modal markers, etc. English, actually, it's funny that many people working within Greek linguistics, I've heard it said, oh, well, Greek has, you know, a very rich aspectual system and might be hard to express something in English because Greek is so rich in its aspectual system. There is no language I have seen that is richer than English in this respect. The example we have here is he might have been being seen. You know, that is an incredibly complex sentence. We can just stack auxiliary after auxiliary after auxiliary. And that shows us something about the structure of the inflectional phrase. So again, those of you that are watching can see this. This is a tree from Von Gelderen showing the structure of this sentence. He might have been being seen. And you can see that we have first, you know, what's combining with the verb phrase, a passive phrase that would be, you know, representing voice, and then progressive phrase, perfect phrase, modal phrase, might, and then, you know, we have T, which is for tense. So here we have all of these different slots, right? All these different functional categories. So again, these are morphemes with logical meanings stacking on top of one another. And the idea here is that even though different languages are going to encode different semantic categories, the order is logical. And therefore, it is pretty universal. So you can see, you know, in English, the order very clearly. But we can take this and we can say, okay, whatever language we're looking at, how do the order of morphemes compare to what we have in English and why? Let's just take Greek as an example. In English, you know, the aspect phrase, right? So the progressive and the perfect, those are often just collapsed into an aspect phrase. In this tree, the aspect phrase is lower than the tense phrase. So the verb combines with aspect before it combines with tense or modality. And this is exactly what we have in Greek. So in Greek, the aspectual system, you can have an imperfective or a perfective, right, or a perfect. You can have those morphemes combine with the verb before tense. And we know that because there are tenseless verbs with aspect. So the idea here is that if I have a verb and I combine it with aspect, then I can then combine it with tense if I want to. I can combine it with a different mood if I want to, like subjunctive mood, the infinitive, right? I can combine it with the indicative and a tense, but that verb already has its aspect with it, right? And even the participle, we can see aspect within the participle as well. So the idea here is that tense is the last thing to be formed, the last functional category to combine with the verb. And that accounts well for the data we see in English and also the data we see in Greek, because you may or may not have tense in any given verb in Greek, but you do have aspect, right? So aspect seems to be closer to the verb logically. Another implication of this that's not related to the semantics of what's in the inflectional phrase, right? Tense, aspect, etc., is that the slot for the subject is the specifier of TP or IP. TP and IP are the same. So tense phrase or inflectional phrase, the subject position typically is thought to be the specifier of the tense phrase or the inflectional phrase. So word order in a language is often dependent upon just how those two things are related. Does the verb move past the specifier of TP? For example, it could move to C, as we'll see a little bit later, or maybe the specifier of the tense phrase is actually unoccupied and the subject starts lower and never makes its way up to the specifier. So this is where the whole discussion of subject, verb, object, this is where all of that comes into play. So it is all dependent upon how these functional categories relate to the subject of the verb. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in the complementizer phrase section, but just want to point out here, because at least in English, this TP slot is special because the subject is there, right? It's always there. And whether or not we have subject first is dependent upon whether the verb has moved past that or not. Okay, so now let's move on to the determiner phrase. So determiners are all about nouns. So the inflectional phrase is all about verbs, whereas the determiner phrase is all about nouns, specifically functional categories that take nouns as arguments. So again, I mentioned this earlier, a boy. A is a kind of determiner, and it takes the word boy as an argument to form a determiner phrase. And that determiner phrase, a boy, acts as a unit in the clause. We're going to define determiner phrase, the functional projection that takes a noun phrase as an argument to anchor the noun in the discourse. English has a pretty rich set of these, you know, so we can think of articles like the and a, demonstratives, this, that, quantifiers, some or all, and numbers, two, three, etc. And all of these need a place in the syntax, and they need to be ordered logically. So this has been done for English and, you know, many other languages. The goal for syntacticians working in the generative grammar field, especially, is to try to come up with structures that are universal. So if you can see this, you can see this tree from Borer 2005. And this is probably looks like total gibberish other than the DP. So basically she has these functional projections that lead up to the DP, and all of these functional projections have to be defined, right? You have to define what each projection is, what each functional category is, give it a meaning, say what goes there, and then you can figure out, well, first of all, you're doing that based on the data. You know, the fact that you have the three cats, for example, shows you that number in English stands between the word the and the noun that it combines with, okay? Greek, though, has actually a much, you know, richer sort of articulation of these categories. Here's an example from Luke 10:36. So in English, we would say, who of these three? In Greek, it's tis tou ton ton trion. And then, you know, the what's understood here is anthropon. So the idea is that we have a demonstrative, tou ton, and then we have an article, a definite article, ton, and then we have the number, trion, right? And then we have, you know, an implicit noun, anthropon, right? Which I just put in parentheses. So you can't say this in English, right? It's literally these, the three people. In English, you would have to, if you use these, you have to drop the. So you can say who of these three people. So this tells us something, right, about how the definite article in Greek is different than the definite article in English. And again, I mentioned this, I think in the last episode on morphology. This tells us that for whatever reason, the semantics of the demonstrative, tuton, is compatible with the semantics of the article, ton, right? Whereas that's not the case in English. They're in complementary distribution. And this complementary distribution is a really important idea in syntax. It shows us, right? Complementary distribution means that two morphemes are not going to occupy the same slot at the same time, right? So if I have the, then I can't have these. If I have these, I can't have the. So I can say who of the three people, right? I can say who of these three, but I can't have both at the same time. So they're occupying the same slot in the syntax. Whereas in Greek, something different is going on because we can have the demonstrative and the article at the same time. They don't seem to be occupying the same slot in the syntax. So that's the important point here. For each language, we need to figure out how are these things ordered logically. And then we have to give a meaning to each of these elements. A crucial thing about determiner phrases is they can serve as arguments of verbs. So this is a kind of hallmark of a DP, a determiner phrase. For example, Ezra gave his stuffed animal to a child. So his stuffed animal is a determiner phrase, and it can serve as an argument of that verb. Ezra is also a determiner phrase in English, because it can serve as an argument of the verb. So both of those are DPs, and the verb, what it needs to be complete, right, the thought, is some sort of element that is a real participant. And determiner phrases, by their nature, they pick out things in the world, right? If I just said the word cat, for example, I don't know how many. I'm not sure. If I said, cat walks, that in English doesn't work, because just the bare word cat, the bare singular in English, doesn't refer in that way. It doesn't refer to something in the world. I would need a cat or a the cat or, two cats or this cat or that cat. But I can't just say cat. So the point is that the verbs need arguments that refer to something, and the determiner phrase is the thing that allows nouns to refer. That's kind of its main function. When all of the functional categories, get boiled down, that's its main function, both in the discourse and in the real world, right? Referring to something previous in the discourse, so you can use a demonstrative and like this and refer to, something that was previously said, or you can point to something in the world, this, right? And you can use your finger and point. So those are the two main things with the determiner phrases. Again, massive work done on both of these things, the order and meaning of the different functional categories that go with nouns, and how these DPs relate to arguments of a verb. Finally, we come to the complementizer phrase. So the complementizer phrase, what we will define as the functional projection that takes an inflectional phrase as an argument, okay? So the inflectional phrase gives us really the sentence. So once we inflect it for tense, we have a complete thought. We have the verb, we have its arguments, we've anchored that in time, right? That's the idea. And now that we have this complete thought, we can do all kinds of things with it. For example, we can question that thought, right? Or we can question that event. So what did Ezra give to a child? Or we can question part of it. What did Ezra give to a child? It's questioning the thing given. The word what is taking the place of a particular argument of give. And that appears at the front of the sentence. So that's what's crucial here, is that, again, and I mentioned this with the questions, for whatever reason, we often in language get these question words at the front of the sentence. And the basic idea is that these question words are actually just found to the left or above the tense or inflectional phrase. So once you form the whole sentence, if you then want to question something, you move that element out to some element in the complementizer phrase. And what that means is, for word order, is that any element in the complementizer phrase may affect the word order of a clause, just like what does in English. What did Ezra give to a child? There we have the object first, what, and then did, we have the verb second. The word order in English is flipped in questions. Same thing happens with a sort of optative in English. May Ezra give his stuffed animal to a child? We put may up front, that is the verb, and or the auxiliary, but that's showing that we have this verb initial sentence with a special meaning, and this is expressing a wish, right? May Ezra give his stuffed animal to a child. So here again, there's some sort of element initial that's before the subject that is giving us a different meaning. I've posted here, again, if you are looking at this, you can see this. I've posted this is called the left periphery, anything past the tense phrase. And this is, this tree that you see is from an article written by Cowper and DeCane. We actually have DeCane on our podcast soon. We'll be releasing an episode where we talk about word order in Hebrew. But this is what they say is the left periphery in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew. These are things that are to the left of the tense phrase and that might affect word order, okay? And there's all kinds of things here. We're not gonna get into each one, but things like topic and focus, right? Things like WH words, casus pendens, all of these kinds of things are going to affect the word order of the clause. As a really concrete example of this, we can think of vayiktol and vekatal in Hebrew. So what's interesting about these verb forms is that they cannot be subordinated. So you can't say, you know, asher vayiktol, right? Or ki vekatal. You can't do that. And again, what we talked about before, this idea of complementary distribution, this means that they're occupying the same slot in the syntax. And we know what ki is doing, right? And what asher is doing syntactically as far as, you know, where it is, because those elements take a full clause after it, right? So it takes a whole TP or IP after it. So that means those elements are, this is what they are, they're complementizers. So a complementizer is something that introduces a complement clause. So if I said, you know, I knew that he would come, I knew that he would come is the complementizer. So that is introducing a complement clause. He would come. He would come is itself a complete thought. And so that is just linking that complete thought to another verb, I knew, and giving us, you know, another complete thought. I knew that he would come. So ki can function in the same way, for example. It can serve as a complementizer to a verb like I know or I knew. And then it has a full tense phrase just a full clause after it. The fact that vayiktol and vekatal cannot come after ki shows us that they occupy the same slot in the syntax. What happens is that the verb, right, moves to the complementizer position. So if you remember, right, if let's just say in Hebrew that the subject is in the specifier of the tense phrase, then the order would be subject verb. But if the verb then moves to the complementizer position, it would move past the subject, right? And we know this to be the case. We know that vayiktol is in complementary distribution with ki or and asher. So that means that it has moved from V to C. That is, like, you know, the evidence that we would need. Regardless of whether we call biblical Hebrew, you know, verb subject or subject verb, the point in this is that some verb forms are going to do unique things. Vayiktol is just, and vekatal are not evidence either way, right? For subject verb or verb subject, they are evidence that these particular verb forms are moving to a higher position in the clause. The fact that you can subordinate katal and yuktol show that they're occupying a different slot, just period, right? They have to be occupying a different slot because they don't behave syntactically in the same way, and they're not in this complementary distribution like vayiktol and vekatal are. So this is just kind of a taste of the kinds of things that you should be thinking about, right, when we're discussing all of these things. And when we're looking at the word order of a particular language or really a particular verb form and what's, you know, quote unquote normal, and what is, you know, marked pragmatically, if something's going to be marked, right, it means that it has moved to the front for something like topic or focus or question or whatever. And that's going to be found in these functional projections that are related to the complementizer phrase. So we have covered a lot, and I know, especially if you're listening to this, your head is probably swimming and you're probably a little bit overwhelmed by all the new terms. I would encourage you, the purpose of this, right, was not to give you all of the answers about all of these things, right? You could spend an entire class on just the determiner phrase easily. So what I wanted to do is just give you a taste of the sorts of things that people are wrestling with in syntax, the sorts of questions that people have found very interesting, that I find very interesting about syntax, And something that would be useful for you. So if you were to say, okay, I want to learn more about the definite article in Hebrew, right? Now you know you need to look into what determiner phrases are doing, right? You need a semantics for the determiner phrase, and you need to see how that interacts with demonstratives, how it interacts with numbers, and nouns, right? All of those go together. And there's been a ton of work done in syntax on determiners and on nouns, right? And so that's the place to start. If you're interested in tense, you know, you need to look at the inflectional phrase and what all those categories mean. If you're interested in, you know, information structure, you can go to the complementizer phrase. If you're interested in lexical issues, right, you go to the verb phrase and how those meanings relate, you know, how verb meanings relate to their arguments, right? These are the kinds of questions that people have been asking for a long time. There's a ton of research in each of these areas. And hopefully this has just helped you to get oriented to what people are saying and really to get you excited about doing syntax. So that brings us back to what it means to do syntax, right? And I just want to go back to this quote by Carney again. He says, syntax studies the level of language that lies between words and the meaning of utterances, sentences. It is the level that mediates between sounds that someone produces, organized into words, and what they intend to say. And then he goes on to say, it's the question of how we subconsciously get from sounds and words to meaning. This is the study of syntax. So the idea is that when we do syntax, what we are doing is we're looking at the phonetic form, the form that we have on the surface, and we're trying to figure out how that produces certain meanings. In order to do this, right, we talked about, we did two things in this episode. In part one, we defined key terms. So we made the distinction that we just discussed between a phonetic form and a logical form. So again, we talked about the sentence, every boy hugged some girl or a girl. And this sentence has multiple interpretations, even though it has one surface form. So we have to have some sort of notion that distinguishes between the form we see on the surface or the form that we hear and how we interpret something. So then we moved on to some important terms to discuss the structure of morphemes. We defined a head as a morpheme that gives the lexical or grammatical category of the whole phrase. So the head is what names the phrase, and a phrase acts together as a single unit in the syntax. So we said a boy, for example, is a determiner phrase. A is the determiner. Boy is the noun. And that acts together as a single unit. And, you know, there are all kinds of tests. We can substitute that for something else that we, you know, also know to be a single unit, another determiner phrase. And so that's what a phrase is. It acts together as a single unit in the syntax. And then we talked about arguments and adjuncts, with arguments being elements required to complete the meaning of another morpheme and adjuncts being optional information. Again, we said that arguments, there are only a set number of them specified by the verb. Adjuncts, in theory, there are unlimited. We can keep adding more information, more adjuncts in the syntax. And then we said there are two different kinds of arguments. There's complements and specifiers, and they have distinct locations, and that leads them to be interpreted differently. So we talked about the no agent idiom hypothesis, right? Where we said for whatever reason, complements can create idioms when they combine with a verb, but it seems like specifiers cannot. So the idea here is that direct objects often create idioms, whereas agents, usually in the specifier of the verb, normally do not create idioms, or never. And so to round out our section on key terms, we discussed movement and why it sometimes occurs. We said it will often occur for meaning purposes. We said Ezra is giving his stuffed animal to a child versus is Ezra giving his stuffed animal to a child, and that movement of is from after the subject to before the subject triggers a new meaning. So all of that was just to introduce the basic, you know, key terms. Again, there are many, many, many terms in syntax that we could have covered that you would need to cover if you're going to look in depth into these things. But hopefully with that, you will be able to, you know, start to see how these basic ideas fit together. And then in part two, we discussed important phrases. So we said, okay, if we have this notion of a phrase, this unit that fits together, that operates as you know, a single unit, we can think of phrases as either lexical or grammatical. So first we touched on the verb phrase, and that's a lexical phrase. And we showed how different verbs could have the same surface structure, but different underlying structures. So this was the pot broke versus the engine coughed, where the pot broke has a different structure than the engine coughed. And we know this because we can add an agent to the pot broke, and we cannot do that with the engine coughed. So this accounts, this underlying difference in their structures accounts for how they behave differently in a variety of syntactic contexts. Second, we touched on the inflectional phrase. So this anchors the event or state named by the verb in time. It takes the verb as its argument, and it is basically the functional projection of the verb. Since all of these things, aspect, modality, tense, they are different functional items that go with the verb. And third, we talked about the determiner phrase, which is the functional projection related to the noun. So this helps to establish what is being referred to by the noun and helps to anchor the noun in the discourse. Finally, we discussed the complementizer phrase. This allows for subordination and all kinds of other clause types besides plain declarative sentences. So we looked at questions, you know, what the WH question or wishes. May Ezra give his stuffed animal to a child? And all of these things are going to affect the normal word order, or they might affect the normal word order. And so we need to account for that, right? If we're going to be talking about what is the quote unquote basic order of a language or a verb type, we need to account for these kinds of meanings that might affect the verb and that might move the verb from one location to another. So we talked in particular about how it seems like vayuktol and vekatal pretty clearly are moving the verb from V, the verb position, to C, the complementizer position. And this is why we don't find it subordinated. So hopefully this discussion has whetted your appetite to begin to explore more fully how morphemes combine in language. That's all we have time for on this episode of the Biblical Languages Podcast. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining me, and I hope you enjoyed the episode.